First speaker this morning is, who is this guy anyway? Well, Scott, we just hired Scott as, Scott Myers, we just hired him as the president of the Foresight Institute, so that's how he got this first speaking gig for today. However, Scott pretty much had to come and be president of the Foresight Institute because he had devoted himself to a career in nanotechnology and had been involved with consulting and founding a number of interesting nanotech companies, including AngstraVision, which built nanotechnology tools. And also, he was originator and chairman of the Nanotech Advisor Opportunity, sorry, the Nanotech Opportunity Report, which was a leading reporter on the commercial opportunities in nanotech. However, when Foresight went looking for a new person to provide us a vision into the future and lead our mission of both advocating nanotechnology and at the same time being a watchdog over it, which is kind of an interesting dual role, we found Scott to have a tremendous breadth of experience in the field, and we're very glad to have him on board. So thank you, and Scott Myers.
Thank you, Brad, and thank you all for coming so early in the morning here. What I want to talk about today is an agenda for high-impact nanotechnology development, and this is part and parcel of kind of an enhancement of the strategic direction of Foresight Institute that we are undertaking now, and I'm going to explain why that is here in the course of the talk. First, I'm going to start with just a quick a summary of sort of where we are in the field, just some orientation. If you caught Ray Kurzweil's talk last night, you got an even more interesting way of looking at that. And to talk a little about short-term versus long-term nanotechnology, and also our strategy for creating high impact in the field. And this involves a couple of things. One, road mapping, which if you saw Dr. Drexler's talk yesterday, you know what we're talking about there, but I'll do a little bit of a review of that and why we decided to pursue that approach. And then talk about the Millennium Challenges, which is a new initiative within Foresight, the second big new initiative, and then what's next for us in terms of trying to create this high impact. The way I think of where we are in the nanotechnology field is we're at the beginning of a very long arc of development that's going to be at least several decades long. It's like where IT was before the integrated circuit was developed, or where recombinant DNA or biotechnology was before recombinant DNA. And again, if you saw Ray Kurzweil's talk last night, we're at the very beginning and the very slow part of an exponential curve in the nanotechnology field. And we've talked a lot yesterday about molecular nanotechnology. There are many different definitions. That's one of the things that's confusing about the field. It means many things to many people. The sort of lowest common denominator definition is the technology of structuring and controlling matter at size scales below 100 nanometers. And the reason why that's important is because new properties come to the fore due to quantum effects and different physical relationships. And it's also about building systems out of that base, those basic building blocks. And we tend to refer this as nanoscale engineering. Nanoscale engineering involves things like nanotubes, fullerenes, nanoparticles, dendrimers, things that you've probably all heard of. And also, one thing that is often a surprise to people is that there are a lot of products that you can go out and buy today that incorporate nanotechnology. So here I've just got a list. I won't even really go through it. You can sort of read them. This presentation will be available on the web as well as others, the others in the conference. But these are all fairly incremental improvements in what typically are consumer products. All very interesting stuff, you know, fantastic that we can go out and buy nanotech-based products today. But these types of products are not really the reason why a lot of us got involved in the field. And in fact, they're not going to have a very big impact on humanity in general and changing the direction of our society. That's the short term. The long-term vision of nanotechnology is something that was first promulgated by Eric Drexler. And the definition that we have settled on for that is a thorough and expensive control, the structure of matter based on molecule-by-molecule control of products and byproducts of molecular manufacturing. This nanoscale engineering that we see today that brings forward these consumer products is really a very early precursor to to molecular nanotechnology, which is really where the big impact's going to come from. And we also, other words that we've used to refer to this longer-term type of nanotechnology are things such as molecular machine systems and nanofactories. And Eric's and John Birch's illustration from yesterday gave you an extremely good example of a potential, a concept for a nanofactory of the future. But what we really want to do in Foresight Institute is figure out how can we create the highest possible impact from our activities and get the most out of nanotechnology. And there are several components to doing that, we believe. One is we've got to articulate a clear pathway or pathways from here to there. I don't think there's only one way to get to the future. There are many ways to get to the future. And it's also, I think, very important to make this relevant to the widest audience possible, to see the full impact. There was a survey done recently that said 80% of the general public had never really heard of nanotechnology. So we've got a long way to go before we can get wide public support for the development of these technologies. The other thing we need is some type of motivation for collective action around certain goals. And another one is a mechanism to unify and coordinate that action, and also a basis for establishing broad alliances so that many groups with many different agendas can be brought together in a collective effort. And one of the things we've decided to do, as I mentioned earlier, to accomplish this is what we're calling the Road Mapping Initiative. And this is a very established method for coordinating stakeholders in a field. I'll give you an example at the very end of this talk about a few roadmaps that have been done already that you might refer to if you're interested in seeing a few of these. But basically what a roadmap does, or at least the variety of roadmap that we want to pursue, is create a vision for a future end state, some place that we want to go, some capability that we want to achieve, and then articulate what are the steps from our current state to that end state. And we also, and what that does several things. One of them is if you map back from the end state to the current state, you get a sense and you illuminate and shine a light on what should we be focusing on today. And this provides us a basis for research and commercialization agendas. And again, if you saw Dr. Drexler's talk yesterday, you saw his first sort of draft, if you will, of a roadmap, which we are going to be building a steering committee around and really make this a very broad effort in the field. But that's, I envision this as only the first in a series. There will probably be other visions of what the end states would be and other ways to get there. And as appropriate, we will probably pursue other roadmaps over time. The other big strategic decision that we've made is we want to align with what we're calling the Millennium Challenges. And this is an effort that grows out of work done by the American Council for the UN University, a gentleman named Jerry Glenn, and he had a collaborator whose name escapes me. Jerry Glenn is the executive director of UN University. But over the last 8 years, they brought together over 1,500 experts worldwide to assess what are the big challenges facing humanity and what should humanity be doing about these challenges. There are other similar lists like this, but not surprisingly, there's a lot of convergence and a lot of overlap and agreement over what are the big challenges. And basically what the goal of the American Council for UN University project was to focus our efforts on the big problems, things that do need to be solved for humanity to have a prosperous future. And it turns out when you take a look down this list, nanotechnology can make a huge contribution to solving these problems. I'm not going to go down each one of these here because I'll address them in separate slides, but these are the actual challenges as they're articulated in the UN report. And I'll give you a reference to this at the end of the talk if you're interested in learning more about this. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go fairly quickly down a list of the challenges that the Millennium Challenges that nanotechnology can address, and then talk about at the 50,000 foot level what are the types of nanotechnologies, the categories of nanotechnologies that can address these problems. The first one is global warming and habitat destruction, achieving sustainable development, which for the most part gets down to global warming and habitat destruction. We're all familiar with the fact that CO2 concentrations have risen in the atmosphere. They've nearly doubled. 3 of the last 5 years have been the hottest on record. We know that glaciers are receding worldwide. There are 1 million more species are expected to go extinct by 2050. Half of the forests are gone. A quarter of the coral reefs are gone. and every year 9.4 million hectares of forest are lost annually. What can we do about this? There are several categories of nanotechnology that can address this. Better fuel cells, better hydrogen storage, better solar cells, a distributed energy generation and storage system. We might even have to go to carbon sequestration as a specific goal in order to reverse the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere. And also higher yield and lower footprint green agriculture. Second, providing clean water to everyone. Water tables are falling on every continent. 1.1 billion people around the world don't have access to safe water. 2.4 billion lack sanitation. 80% of the developing world diseases are waterborne. And agriculture uses 70% of this water. And there's expected to be a 60% increase needed to feed 2 billion more people by 2030. The main solutions to this are inexpensive, decentralized water purification. And one of our speakers later on today is going to, in fact, address this specific topic. And another one is agricultural methods that use less water so that big chunk of the pie is reduced significantly. Next, balancing population and resources. Over a billion people live in slums and squatter communities around the world. We expect to have a population of 8.9 billion by 2050. 98% of those will be in poor countries. 5 billion will be city dwellers by 2030. Today, 40% of humanity lives in two countries, India and China, and those countries are developing rapidly. And that just all of those create increasing demands for nutrition, shelter, water, and sanitation. Life expectancy, if we go on the current historical pathway, is expected to go from 65 to 75 by 2050. There are a lot of people in this room that probably think that that's going to be significantly longer by 2050. But taking those statistics, there would be 2 billion more people over 60 in 2050. World grain harvests have been falling short in the last 4 years. And biodiversity is being destroyed worldwide, as I mentioned in the previous slide. Some of the solutions from the nanotech realm include zero-waste manufacturing, increasing the durability of manufactured goods so that they last longer, fully recyclable products, inexpensive decentralized water purification. Again, you'll see that there are some themes that run across several of these challenges, and also environmentally friendly building materials, perhaps replacements for wood and things of that variety. Next problem is making information and technology available to everyone. The main problem is we need a planetary nervous system. We need something that allows everyone to communicate and coordinate. And for that, we need pervasive, inexpensive computing. If you listen to any of the technology people from Intel, I know there's one Intel person here, one of the main strategic thrusts of Intel is pervasive computing, and that's definitely where the field's going. And we also need ubiquitous communication for education, for democratization, for economic growth, and to coordinate collective action, particularly to address the millennium challenges. Some of the solutions that nanotech can provide are drastic reduction in the cost and increase of performance of computing devices. And the big impacts there will be in memories, displays, processors, making computers solar-powered. There are several companies working on flexible solar cells that can accomplish that by making the actual cases of the computers where the energy is generated, and also embedded intelligence. And this is the idea of putting computing devices in almost everything, clothes, cars, everyday devices, essentially making all the objects that we create intelligent objects that can be networked together. In order to do that, we need pervasive self-configured networks. And one of the more far-reaching incarnations of that idea are smart dust and swarms. You may have heard of that before. The next problem is combating infectious diseases. 30% of deaths worldwide are caused by infectious diseases. 30 new highly infectious diseases have evolved in the last 20 years, and this includes things like HIV/AIDS, SARS, Ebola, avian flu, and others. And reappearance of diseases that we thought we had eliminated and resistance to antibiotics are a huge problem. And globalization, the process that's going on now, only increases exposure and increases the acuteness of this problem. HIV/AIDS is the most critical, as we all know. Just some statistics, 22 million people have been killed so far and 42 million are infected globally. And it's the leading cause of death in sub-Saharan Africa. And another thing that is also related to infectious disease is the threat of bioterrorism and the use of infectious disease in bioterrorism. Some of the solutions that can address these problems include inexpensive rapid diagnostics, more effective antivirals and antibiotics, which would come from new methods of drug delivery and greater ability to store and administer drugs, faster development of new drugs, and inexpensive ubiquitous biosensors to detect infectious disease spread. Next item, which is somewhat related, is reducing the threat of terrorism. And the problem is there's increasing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. They're more accessible and less expensive all the time. There's also what I'm just calling the demonization of other cultures and societies. Typically these days we're being demonized. And also just the general poverty and inequality around the planet, which exacerbates and gives rise to terrorism. So some of the solutions include pervasive sensors and monitoring so we can at least detect some of this activity. Pervasive computing and communication, which we hope would increase cross-cultural understanding and cross-cultural cooperation. And also many of the solutions that I mentioned in the previous slides essentially would work to level the playing field so that we'd eliminate this inequality and poverty which gives rise to the terrorism. The next challenge is meeting global energy needs. Demand we expect to increase by at least 50% by 2025, and that would translate into $16 trillion required to meet the demand by 2030 if we go through by the traditional pathways, the straight extrapolations. Today, 1.6 billion people have no access to electricity. 2.4 billion rely on burning biomass, which contributes to the global warming problem. And we're on track for only 10% renewables in our energy stream by 2025. That's not enough. Fossil fuel consumption over that period of time could double, and the developing world is expected to surpass the developed world in the consumption of fossil fuels. Some solutions: better fuel cells, better hydrogen storage, better solar cells, better batteries, more efficient lighting, and decentralized generation and storage. And essentially what we need to do is to reinvent the power grid. And some of you are familiar with Richard Smalley, who is a debate partner very often, but his main push these days is this whole reinvention of the power grid. So it's a widely recognized problem and solution. And finally, accelerating scientific and technological breakthroughs. If you saw Ray Kurzweil's talk last night, you're probably pretty hopeful about that, because we've got an accelerating or double accelerating curve going on. And we know that technology, and particularly the development of nanotechnology, accelerating. The question is it fast enough to address the key challenges, and are we focusing on the right things? Some solutions to this is a global focus on the Millennium Challenges, coordination among all the stakeholders to address them, more focused R&D funding, better commercialization mechanisms, new business models to attack these problems, and also new incentives. And we talked a little bit about prizes and incentive prizes such as the X Prize, which was won recently. And Peter Diamandis, who's the person behind the X Prize, is heading up our new steering committee for enhancing our prizes specifically to spur more and more of this activity. I looked down this list and said, what are some big problems that aren't addressed by a Millennium Challenges that Foresight Institute is still very interested in and will be pursuing? And I just put a couple on here: cancer, anti-aging, and space development. Apparently this isn't a Millennium Challenge, but these are, you know, big things, big problems that we want to solve, or big adventures that we want to undertake. And we also believe that nanotechnology should be applied to these problems aggressively. What's next? Collaboration of all the stakeholders. Focus on the technology solutions that I mentioned. Synergizing the technological and non-technological solutions. We don't believe that this is completely a technological issue. It's a societal issue and a human consciousness issue. And Foresight is here to help. What we want to do is be, you know, someone who is driving the effort to address these problems, and we're going to be putting our resources behind that. And finally, these are some of the resources: the Foresight site, the Millennium Project Global Challenge site, and also the Nanotech Opportunity Report. For those of you who want to get a very thorough picture of where we are now, this is the best source of information on that. You can buy that at a discount through Foresight Institute if you go to our site or talk to folks out at the desk. And then the final three are just three examples of roadmaps that exist out there, one in from the materials realm, one from the information technology realm, and one from the health and medicine realm. And again, these slides will all be available on the web in the next few days, and so you can go and refer to those if you want to go to these websites and get a sense of what roadmaps have been developed already. So with that, thank you very much.
You got me? There you go. Now, Scott set a wonderful example by not taking his full 30 minutes, and I want to do two things with that. One is I want to engage the audience into these issues. Yesterday, we focused on research, which is a pretty important part of what the Foresight Institute does. But the other and equally important component is considering the issues behind nanotechnology and the applications. We actually discouraged talk of that yesterday a little bit because we want to focus it into the next 2 days. So I encourage you both to ask questions of the speakers that get to the points that you're interested in about both the applications and the issues, and also to participate in hallway conversation, which I think is a very important part of this conference. So I want to make sure we get the full break time. So first, let's start if you have some questions for Scott. I think you were first, actually. Yes, Brown's with you.
Let's get a mic up there.
Do you want to? We've got some mic runners today. Oh, there's a woman in a brown suit there at the third from the back.
Yeah, this is more a comment than a question. I work in the field of global warming, and ultimately, global warming and meeting energy needs are basically the same issue. And in your list of the ways that nanotechnology could be applied, the only energy efficiency thing on the entire list was more efficient lighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to encourage you to think more broadly of the application of nanotechnology to reducing energy use, not only in buildings, but in industrial applications and in appliances generally, consumer products, because at least in the near and midterm, I think the opportunities for nanotechnology to really impact both global warming and the whole energy problem will be in those areas more than in solar cells even or the hydrogen fuel cell concept. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll add that to the presentation.
By the way, as a Canadian, just let me say, what's the big deal with global warming? Why are you against it?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Michael Mehta from Canada. I'd like to thank Scott, actually, for his presentation. That's a good overview. My question is this. What role does Foresight play in facilitating public dialogue or public understanding of science with respect to nano? I'd like to make a quick preamble on that as well. A lot of people have suggested that nuclear power is an example of a technology that's good science and bad politics. GMO may fall into the same kind of trap. What is it about nano that's different, and why did you know, how can we actually get the ball rolling without having some of these impediments come into play?
Well, that's a pretty broad question, a couple questions in there. How do we get the ball rolling without falling into the same traps as nuclear energy and GMO? I think we have to be very proactive, and I think that if you look at the Foresight guidelines, this is our effort to be extremely proactive for the long-term technology. If you take a look at the guidelines, it doesn't really apply to nanoparticles that much because nanoparticles don't have the types of capabilities that we're contemplating with molecular nanotechnology, for instance. So we've, you know, that's one thing we've done in the public arena too, and those were modeled very explicitly on the Asilomar efforts that happened in the biotechnology field in the 70s, which were very successful. Another thing, you know, if you look at our website, that's 3,000 pages of information about nanotechnology, everything you can imagine, and so that's, you know, one of our contributions to educating the public. And another thing we're doing is that we've begun to work with the policy community and the legislative government community to bring them up the learning curve on nanotechnology and to start to promulgate these types of ideas. And is Linda Strine in the audience? Linda, if you're here, stand up and raise your hand. Linda Strine is our government affairs person, and she comes out of the aerospace industry. and is helping us in Washington to communicate this message. And so that's some of the major things that we're doing to address this. And I guess finally, one of the points I made here is that the reason for doing a roadmap is so that you can pursuing the Millennium Challenges in particular, actually, is it gives you a basis to build alliances. One of the experiences I had is I phoned up one of the presidents of one of the more well-known environmental groups and said, hey, I run this nonprofit. It's about nanotechnology. I think we may have some common mutual goals here, some synergistic goals. And he said, I just don't see what nanotechnology has to do with the environment. And I started reeling off for him the Millennium Challenges and what nanotechnology could do. And he said, well, that's our issue. That's our issue. That's our issue. And so I knew we were on the right track then, because we can bring together groups that you wouldn't normally think of as allies by pursuing this type of a strategy. And that was one of the core reasons for pursuing this strategy.
Yeah, I just want, at the risk of being, let me just preamble this by saying, okay. Let me just preamble this by saying that, I'm very much supporting the development of nanotechnology, but as you went down through that list, there's one question I think that you need to ask yourself, and we as a community need to ask this, is if we're successful at all this, what happens then? Because what you're talking about is improving efficiency, improving access to resources, and that sort of thing, but what... It also means that we're going to live longer, the population's going to go up, and although you're solving these problems at this level, all we're doing is creating another set of problems that are going to occur because of our...
Which is, and the problem is higher population, or... Yeah, exactly. This is the big issue. But two quick things is if you look at the demographics in developing versus developed countries, population growth tends to go to zero in the developed countries. Okay, so we will have the problem of longer lifespans, and one might say that's why we need to go into space eventually. But a big part of the problem can be solved by just raising the living standard around the world. On the other side, about the need for greater resources, if we reduce our environmental footprint and we have a system, way of living that in fact integrates into the natural systems in a sustainable way, then the planet can support far more people than exist on the planet today. The problem with how we do it today is it's not sustainable.
Well, yeah, you have the same issue that we did this in the Industrial Revolution, and if we can use that as an example, or the Agricultural Revolution. Both times we did exactly what you just said. We reduced the environmental footprint, we became more efficient, and that led to increased population and increased pressure globally.
I don't think we reduced the environmental footprint. I just...
Environmental footprint. Each time you've increased the efficiency and you've gone through a technology.
That's not how I understand the word environmental footprint. But maybe we should talk about that offline.
If you can be really brief for the last question.
Last Friday, Saturday in upstate New York, we have a small scale nanotechnology application. Try to educate the general public, the local people, the high school and the college professor, student. I got one question I'd like to get answered from here. So several of them ask, have we considered the environmental impact for the development of nanotechnology? I hope I get some answer from here.
Yes, thanks.
Yeah, that's at least within the Foresight Institute, that's a very key consideration. And, you know, when you think about, you know, our focus on things such as zero-waste manufacturing or approaching zero-waste manufacturing, that's all about reducing the environmental footprint, for instance. And there are others.
Thanks very much, Scott.